I'm glad you know this field because I have a personal fascination with the fluoropolymers.
So yeah.
Why don't you?
Well, so do I.
You were talking about the
vinyl fluoride.
Vinyl fluoride versus polyvinylidene fluoride.
Yeah. Okay. Vinyl fluorides from hydrogen fluoride and acetylene. Vinylidene fluoride is made by addition of two molecules of hydrogen fluoride to acetylene to make difluoroethane, chlorination of difluoroethane, and then pyrolysis or elimination of hydrogen chloride. So it's obviously a lot more expensive than vinyl fluoride. You all right?
We're doing fine.
Okay. So, having seen that the physical properties of polyvinyl fluoride were so good, the Central Chemical Department naturally chose to concentrate on vinyl fluoride. Their concentration on the properties of vinyl fluoride was almost coincident with the start of the war, and it was quite impossible to maintain both. In a normal course of events, they'd have maintained both. So they were able to get a draft clearance for the chemist working. It was Fred Johnston, now working on vinyl fluoride. He was concerned with the development of it.
Yes.
I'm not sure who first found it. It might have been Tom Ford. It might have been somebody else. That's easy to check. But in any case, they concentrated on vinyl fluoride and trying to make both moldable plastic and films and fibers. It wasn't realized until we were well into the development that polyvinyl fluoride had a fatal flaw. The temperature at which it molded cleanly was so close to the temperature of exothermic decomposition that very frequently when you were molding a piece of polyvinyl fluoride plastic, you'd blow the mold up. And we never did solve this problem with stabilizers of any sort. There were a number of other fluoropolymers.
Get Tedlar film.
That comes later.
No, that comes later.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll finish off with this war thing. We gave up a number of other very interesting polymers at this time. They're all coincident. John Rowland discovered that copolymers of propylene and tetrafluoroethylene were elastomers. And I discovered that the copolymers of ethylene and trifluoropropene, that's CF3 derivative of ethylene, were elastomeric. And these were very interesting polymers, but we didn't have, with the wartime and the inability to get people away from wartime projects, we had to abandon them. Polyvinyl fluoride we picked up during the 50s at the time when I was assistant director of Jackson Lab. I picked up responsibility for fluorine research in Jackson Lab, and we were looking around for new outlets for our capability in fluorine chemistry other than propellants and refrigerants. We were looking for other big businesses, and we chose to take a look at polymerizable intermediates, which immediately brought up vinylidene fluoride and vinyl fluoride. And this is why when this request came from Hanford relative to give us a license, we were singularly alert because we were looking for things ourselves. We weren't it didn't catch us fallow. We were really ready. It had been found during the course of the vinyl fluoride development, just by luck, that polyvinyl fluoride and polyvinylidene fluoride, when made into paints, were extraordinarily light fast. This was an accident because over the warp period, some panels were sent down to Hialeah in Florida and neglected. And these panels had been sitting down there in Florida for almost 10 years. When somebody down at the paint farm says, "Hey, don't you want these panels?" So they took these panels back and looked at them, and where most of the finishes used in the paints had turned to chalk or nothing, there were these polyvinylidene fluoride and polyvinyl fluoride finishes in pristine condition. Nothing wrong with them.
These were clear coat finishes?
Yeah, clear coat and also pigmented, just perfect. No, mm-hmm. The reason for this is that both these polymers are transparent to UV.
Yes.
So the natural processes that generate radicals and decompose them don't occur. You don't get any energy where it counts. And then on top of that, the there's no hydrogen in either polymer that's really hot in the sense of being detachable by a free radical, okay?
Yes.
This interested our film people a little bit, so efforts started to be made in our central research department and in our plastics department to see if something couldn't be done with these polymers. The final outcome of this was the film started to look quite interesting. By now, a film department was formed, and the film department was looking for some other film than cellophane on which it had been formed, polyethylene, which didn't look practical, polyethylene terephthalate, which was gone. They were looking for some new films, so they got a little interested in polyvinyl fluoride, and as a salesman for fluorochemistry, I started promoting polyvinyl fluoride around the company. Got film more than interested. In fact, we spontaneously undertook research work on our own. Mm-hmm. On both these products to get film more interested. And all of this ferment led to the development of Tedlar. It was a cooperative thing where they were looking for something new and I was pushing, trying to get rid of fluoromonomer, okay?
Tedlar is still on the market.
Yeah.
A successful product.
Yeah.
How about that? Did we license?
We gave
some out to the polyvinylidene.
Yeah, we licensed. We licensed Hanford to. We licensed Kellogg to the other patent.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would have been a dog in the manger kind of thing not to. You know, it wouldn't have been too good when the, especially when it, what they were trying to do was intended for an important use. Mm-hmm. So we licensed. And then 3M bought that business from Kellogg.
Okay, I guess we ought to get into the next big one, which I presume is the
Nordel.
Nordel, polyolefins.
Well, Nordel. When we were in the early 50s now, we're 1952, 53, somewhere in there. We were manufacturing again polychloroprene, looking at polyurethanes. Exxon had a product that sort of annoyed us. That's butyl rubber. We thought a better job could be done with butyl rubber than butyl rubber on a hydrocarbon polymer, something cheap. And I asked Madison Hunt to put somebody on making a hydrocarbon polymer other than other than polyisobutylene, and putting a pendant rather than an in-chain double bond on it. The only polymer, the only monomer that looked as though we had a chance was propylene, because it had been polymerized ionically. So we undertook a study. I think Al Haven was given the job. We started a study of propylene polymers, trying to figure out how we could get the molecular weight up and get a side chain unsaturated monomer in there. Within a month or so after we got going on this, the Ziegler chemistry hit. Independent of Ziegler, Gresham and his group in the then polychemicals department discovered coordination polymerization and the ability to polymerize ethylene. So we just, instead of working any further with these propylene things, which are hard to do, we quickly switched over to Gresham's coordination polymerization, and Haven started playing with copolymers of ethylene and propylene. And along the long side chain monomer we had devised, I forget it, it was a heptene with a side group. This was spectacularly successful, and we very, very quickly had a nice looking rubber. Nice, beautiful rubber. And this is the subject of the Gresham and Hunt patent. It was very hard in all this melange to figure out who the inventor was. So we just took the representatives of the two groups, Gresham and Hunt. Okay? Because there was an awful lot going on in polychemicals and an awful lot going on in our space. And you have to be practical. The polymer was going along great guns. And then we decided that it was so good we'd build a little semi-works. So we built a little pilot plant to manufacture this stuff with control monomer feeds and all that sort of stuff. But then since we were in Hypalon by then, we decided we'd see what we could do if we chlorosulfonated some of the ethylene propylene polymer itself to make a nice new Hypalon. And this made a beautiful Hypalon. This analog of Hypalon was so much more like a rubber than Hypalon that produced a very lustful reaction on the part of our management in Wilmington. They forced us to stop the work we'd been doing on the new hydrocarbon polymer and go after the Hypalon.
Let's go back and talk a little bit about what Hypalon is and
Hypalon
what its advantages were.
Hypalon, the product Hypalon was discovered by Ambrose McAlevey in the old plastics department. His boss, Roger Williams, who became the research vice president for DuPont, wanted to make as many plastics as he possibly could, and was jealous of the fact that the organic chemicals department had a synthetic rubber. So he asked, through appropriate channels, he asked McAlevey to make him a rubber. And they fingered polyethylene because Central Research some years earlier had chlorosulfonated polyethylene using the Reed reaction, chlorine and SO2, and made a pretty good leather substitute. So Brose went to work on, he decided he would take on polyethylene and this chlorosulfonation reaction, and he chlorinated and chlorosulfonated polyethylene and made a product which contained, I don't know, 20-odd% chlorine and about 1% of SO2Cl groups, which turned out to be a not bad rubber with excellent ozone resistance and excellent light resistance. But it was a terrible rubber in terms of strength and processing characteristics. The chlorosulfonated ethylene propylene analog that we made got around these difficulties. We were able to get much more chlorine into it so that the solvent resistance was better, and the rubbery characteristics were better. The viscosity was higher, and it processed more like a rubber, less like a soft soupy plastic. But when in accordance with the orders from on high we took off after this, we very quickly found that this beautiful rubber wasn't thermally stable, had too many tertiary chlorines in it, and also was subject to dehydrochlorination and oxidation and cleavage on long-term exposure. So we started, we recognized that this was caused by the the substitution on the tertiary hydrogen, tertiary carbon. So we started backing the propylene out of the structure and ended up with chlorosulfonated linear polyethylene, which turned out to be the Hypolon. That was Hypolon 40.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And the patent for that, I think, is Paul Johnson and Mal Smook.
Mm-hmm.
And Mal is a good one to talk to if you want history on Hypolon.
Oh.
He was at Polychem when this happened. He was the one who told me about Williams telling Ambrose.
I see. Okay.
Okay.
This was...
But
that's a picture of more cooperation than I felt there was between the departments.
Well, there isn't quite as much cooperation as you think here. Plastics department tried very hard to, or ammonia, I forget whether it was ammonia or plastics, I think it was ammonia, tried very hard with Williams to get a hold of this business and to build a plant to manufacture this Hypolon. And the entrenched forces of conservatism, Orchem, with a very nice neoprene business by now,
mm-hmm.
fought very hard against this brash newcomer. And the brash newcomer was claiming it was the same, all this in heaven too. This led to a executive committee confrontation. And as a result of this confrontation, the organic chemicals department was given Hypolon. It was taken away from Williams. It was given to Orchem. So one department was robbed of something it was proud of, and the other department had something shoved at it that it really didn't want.
Really?
Yeah. So Hypolon was not Hypolon wasn't regarded with pleasure by the organic chemicals department. My boss, Nick Carter, thought it was poison. In fact, he thought it was such poison that he looked at it and he said, "Herman, you take it. I don't want to have anything to do with this." You assume responsibility for it.
I see.
He was so proud of neoprene, in which he played a big part.
Well, my feeling was that some opportunities were missed over the years because plastics was only interested in something that was plastic. Elastic.
Yeah, well, they were. There's no question about it. You're right.
And the thermoplastic business
I agree.
Came later than it should have probably. But
oh, yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There were many, many examples of things that came up through the 60s. and 70s, where we would have ideas in our department. Various people would have ideas, and I would have to veto them as far as any extended work goes, solely on the basis they weren't our business, or tell the fellows to do them quietly and don't tell me about them. Because it was really doing something the other department couldn't be, and at the same time, the other department was singularly unsuggestible about... I flicked this, I'm sorry.
No, I'm...
I did what... This
that didn't work that time.
It didn't, all right, okay. You're dead right.
We might get back to that. Is there something more to be said about the Nordell?
The Nordell was a... There's a lot to be said about the Nordell. You could spend hours talking about that development. It was...
One particular question. Exxon came in with their... dicyclo pentadiene?
Oh, yeah, well...
Termonomer, and that was one that we hadn't covered?
No, this is very complex. You really could spend hours on this one. DuPont made the first polymers with linear diolefins, hexadiene, heptadiene, things like that, and got the basic patent. DuPont also... Stamatov in plastics department polymerized dicyclopentadiene and norbornenes. And Herb Eleuterio polymerized those and made the linear polymers. You know, like polypentenamer, things like that. The basic patents on all those are Herb Eleuterio's. Tungsten and the like catalysts. We put a man to work on norbornene and dicyclopentadiene polymers, and a guy named Vaughan. Remember C. Wheaton Vaughan?
Yes.
Yeah, he didn't really like the project, and he just simulated some experiments and never did them. Told us they didn't work. Year or so later, I asked Gladding to go back and take a look at that stuff. And we polymerized ethylene propylene with things like methylene norbornene, vinyl norbornene, and cyclopentadiene itself, things like this. And these all worked, and we have patents. There's one with, I forget who all the inventors are, there's a Gladding and Robinson, a Gladding and somebody else, and I have one. Then in the middle of all this, when we were pursuing the... we got these patents on these things, but not dicyclopentadiene, because we had Vaughan's work that said it didn't work. In the middle of this, a Dunlop patent came out to a couple of people who worked in the Dunlop of Canada laboratory. I forget the names of them all. One was Wilf Cooper, and the other fellow, his name is, it's a sort of a Russian name or a Slavic name, nice guy. But they did a very nice piece of work on this, and they made some pretty good-looking dicyclopentadiene rubbers. We took a look at those and decided that they really weren't anywhere near as good as the kind of product we were making, so we chose not to go any further with them. But we also did enough to know that the some of those other norbornene things were good. I'm just trying to think. About 1960 or 61, we built ourselves a pilot plant to make our ethylene propylene hexadiene polymer, which we called ECD-326, and gave a paper on it. In fact, we gave several papers. Papers were given at the Gordon Conference and also out at an ACS meeting. There were some papers by Verbank and some papers by Gladding, and we covered this stuff. This development elicited great reactions of lust and passion in the rubber industry, and Exxon came in to see us and said they would like to make one of these things, and they would like to make the one we were making, and we said no, but we'd be glad to license you to one of the other ones if you'd like. So we licensed Exxon to the methylene norbornene patent. That's the ethylidene norbornene area. And they were satisfied. See, we were in a position where refusing Exxon a license is very difficult when they're one of the company's largest customers for tetraethyl lead. And we had excellent relationships with them. We'd had a semi-partnership with them on the manufacture of tetraethyl lead, which had been dissolved many years before. Like, they were responsible for sales and we were responsible for manufacture. And it was an awful lot of business. Plus good industrial relations, and refusing was almost impossible.
Yes.
So we gave them a license. There was from DuPont's standpoint, a very sad, almost comical occurrence here. When Gladding's fellas did the work on these bridged ring strained olefins like ethylidene norbornene, methylene norbornene, and we patented them all individually because of the fact that there was this case which we picked up in Australia or something like that, that was going to be on dicyclopentadiene to Dunlop. So we couldn't patent the whole class because too much water had gone down the river. So we had to patent the individuals. And we tossed in a patent application on ethylidene norbornene and methylene norbornene. Gladding was the division head. And the patent lawyer who was responsible for this was a character named Steinbauer, who was a very poor patent lawyer. And unbeknownst to me, the case that we filed was not the case that I had approved. Steinbauer persuaded Gladding that he could not cover ethylidene norbornene and methylene norbornene in the same case. So since Gladding had more information on a methylene norbornene, the ethylidene norbornene was scrubbed from the case, and I never knew this until the damn patent issued. And as a result of this, the most important monomer outside of the hexadiene type, and the one that's used by all our competitors, was patent-free, scot-free. The disclosure was in the patent, but there was no case.
I'll be darned.
Terrible, terrible.
I guess that may have been the tale I'd heard.
Yeah, we fired Steinbauer. Mm. He later went to work for 3M, and then they fired him. Mm. Awful nice guy, but utterly incompetent. And I don't know how much money he cost us. I don't know if you want that story, but that's true.
No, I'm delighted with all these stories.
Go ahead. Ready?
Calrus.
Okay. We discovered Viton and many improvements on Viton over the course of our years working with it, but it became quite apparent that, good as it wasn't good enough for many of the uses that really were hitting us in an age when things were going off into space or going down 5 miles in the ground where the temperatures and conditions were terrible. So starting as early as the late 50s, we really went to work trying to get a hold of a better fluoroelastomer, and pretty well exhausted the normal possibilities outside of the fluorocarbon field. We exhausted the possibilities of exotic things and decided we really had to get back to home territory and take a look at TFE chemistry and the like, and find out how to get it more flexible. Due to some very excellent work in plastics polychemicals department, in Gresham's book group, Art Anderson and others, Herb Bellaterio too, the peroxidation of TFE to tetrafluoroethylene oxide and hexafluoropropylene to its corresponding oxide were discovered, and this in turn led to the some interesting chemistry in the synthesis of a perfluoro vinyl ether.